Item one, federal regulations, lots of them. Item two, the equity in sweat, lots of equity. Item three, nail polish, just a little bit of that, actually, is probably enough. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday, the 5th of May. Glad you could be with us, everybody. Our lead story today is brought to us by the fine print. The sometimes pages and pages of stuff that we all, and let's just be honest here, don't read when we're signing up for credit cards, in today's example. Buried just deep enough so you couldn't easily find it, even if you went looking usually, is a clause about binding arbitration that says you can't sue the bank that gave you the card. You have to go to arbitration and let a third party decide. I mention that because today the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau rolled out some new proposed rules that would indeed let customers sue in class action suits only, it should be said. What should also be said, though, is what's not in those new rules. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has that one.
The CFPB's proposed rule would allow class action suits for most consumer financial products, things like credit cards, prepaid cards, and payday loans. But the rule wouldn't apply to for-profit schools, for example.
Some for-profit schools engage in deceptive and fraudulent practices.
That's Lauren Saunders. She's Associate Director of the National Consumer Law Center.
Some schools even close and leave students holding thousands of dollars of student loans.
So even though Saunders supports the proposed rule, she says it doesn't go far enough. You still can't file class action suits against a car dealer who sells you a lemon or nursing homes that neglect patients. James Copeland says that's a good thing. Copeland is a senior fellow at the Center Right Manhattan Institute. He says consumers get a raw deal in class actions.
Most of these cases are essentially designed to get large payouts to the lawyers, and the consumers get a few dollars on the side.
Copeland says consumers are better off under arbitration, where they bring their case before an arbitrator who's usually paid by the company involved in the dispute. But don't tell that to attorney Ray Gallo. He says you need the wisdom of a jury, because in arbitration,
there's no group wisdom, there's no appeal, so whatever arbitrary thing that one arbitrator who's got an institutional bias is the rule and the end of it.
And Gallo points out, under the proposed rule, individuals can't sue. They still have to go through arbitration because the rule would only allow class action lawsuits. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Today clearly was a rulemaking kind of day for the federal bureaucracy. Not to be left out was the Food and Drug Administration, which this morning offered its latest take on e-cigarettes, cigars, hookahs, pretty much anything. It has tobacco in it. The proposed rules are retroactive, meaning that products on the market right now are going to have to go back and get approval from the FDA. That'd be huge for the $3 billion electronic cigarette industry, vape shops in the vernacular. Could even be fatal. Marketplace's Nova Sappho has more on that.
The FDA's new rules require approvals for existing e-cigarette products and prohibit sales to minors. At New York City's Henley Vaporium, shop owner Peter Denholz was still processing the new rules.
They're 499 pages, and it's going to take a while before we really understand what they mean.
What we do know is that e-cigarette shops and manufacturers will have a grace period of up to 3 years to figure things out. Denholz's attorney Phil Damon says he's worried that eventually vape shops like the Henley Vaporium will go out of business.
If you're selling multiple kinds of vaporizers, each one of those has to apply for a pre-market approval, and that's going to cost significant dollars.
Exactly how many dollars, Damon can't say yet. Estimates have ranged anywhere from a few hundred thousand to multiple millions. But Maggie Mahoney of the Tobacco Control Legal Consortium says regulators needed to act. Mahoney's group works with public health departments, and she says there's growing evidence that young people are getting hooked to nicotine-containing e-cigarettes.
There may be a perception that the products are safer because you're not burning tobacco like you would with a cigarette.
The FDA says its new rules will help change those perceptions. Here's Health and Human Services Secretary Sylvia Burwell in an online video message this morning.
Consumers will gain access to information, and risks associated with these new products will be clearer and easier to understand.
Still, the e-cigarette industry isn't ready to give in. Attorney Phil Damon, who's part of an industry coalition, hopes to prevent the FDA's new rules from taking effect.
We feel the FDA has overstepped its bounds, and we would expect legal action to be forthcoming.
In addition, Damon says they'll be lobbying legislators to change the law. I'm Nova Sappho for Marketplace.
Tomorrow, to most of you, is Friday. Tomorrow, to people in my line of work, is the third Friday after the conclusion of the reference week, i.e. the week which includes the 12th of the month. We, though, like to just call it Jobs Day around here. The April unemployment report lands at 8:30 Washington time, which is a very long way of saying Wall Street today was a snoozer, man. What with everybody waiting for that report? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Here are the facts as we know them. A low-income community contaminated with lead, tens of thousands of people at risk, and a slow, at best, government response. It could be Flint, yes, but I'm talking about the East LA neighborhood of Boyle Heights, where a battery recycling plant sat for decades, and where the resulting lead contamination has spread into the soil of neighborhood yards nearby. Recently, $176 million was earmarked for cleanup, which sounds like a win until you find out how much there is to do. Marketplace's Jed Kim reports.
There are right ways and wrong ways to approach the people who live around the former Exide Technologies plant. The area is heavily industrial, its residents largely Latino, many of them poor. Even just getting to a front door isn't easy. Protective fences surround a lot of houses, lots of dogs. Jessica Prieto knows how to get a homeowner's attention, though. She just taps her fences with a pen or a clipboard.
So this is how you knock?
Yeah, just in case they have dogs.
Once she's got their attention, there's the hook. Information they really need.
Hi, I'm registering residents to have their soil tested for possible lead contamination.
Prieto is with the group East Yard Communities for Environmental Justice. She signed up a few people today. Not bad for a weekday.
That's fine. Usually during the outreach events that we have, those are like when we get the most signatures.
So that's a right way. A wrong way would be approaching a resident with a microphone, like I did.
Oh, I'm not gonna go on your radio.
It's a public radio show. Are you sure?
I didn't want to go on your radio.
Okay.
There are lots of other wrong ways to go about getting this community's trust. First off, there's the whole contaminating homes with lead thing, possibly 10,000 within a 1.7-mile radius. That's what the battery recycler is accused of. Exide didn't respond to requests for interview. The California government has also made mistakes. The Department of Toxic Substances Control allowed the company to operate for decades on an essentially obsolete permit. Gladys Limon is an attorney with Communities for a Better Environment.
The pattern of conduct of the agency, in our mind, shows that they have clearly prioritized business interests over securing the health and safety of these communities, which is their mission.
That's a problem because the agency is now in charge of cleaning up residents' contaminated yards, and it needs signed permission from residents just to test the soil. This effort will take enormous community buy-in, but that could be tough, says Lisa Schweitzer, a professor at the USC School of Public Policy.
One of the real problems in this is that communities really have no reason to trust government if they haven't done a good job of being a custodian or steward of the industry prior to this.
The department says it is working to improve that. Ana Mascareñas is Assistant Director for Environmental Justice.
It is about maintaining regular communication, transparency, accountability, and I think that's what we are working towards, especially with this additional funding to be able to do enhanced outreach with the community.
That enhanced outreach includes working with more community groups to do door-to-door canvassing. East Yard Communities recently received a contract to sign people up for testing. Jessica Prieto's, by the way, gotten another signature.
Thank you for stopping by.
Community groups say the department has improved since a new director came in. Some missteps have still occurred, though. Recently, community members fought down an effort to speed the cleanup by exempting it from major environmental protection requirements. So far, about 1,300 yards have been tested and 200 cleaned. The money for the cleanup should cover testing and cleanup of 2,500 yards. Amelia Vallejo's soil was replaced about a month ago. Standing in her front yard, she looks at the new sod.
I think it's great, but the damage has been done. this Excite battery plant has ruined my family for the rest of their lives, with my son being disabled, and he's only 5 years old.
Her son, Michael, is developmentally delayed, mostly deaf, and has vision problems. She attributes this to the lead. California says soil is hazardous if lead's at 400 parts per million. The highest category of contamination is 1,000 parts per million. Vallejo's yard was at 1,500.
Where's John? He went home? Where's Michael?
Home.
You're home? Is this Michael's home?
Vallejo says she's disappointed with the state for how it's handled things. Still, she's pushing her neighbors to cooperate and sign up for testing. She doesn't want Michael's home to get recontaminated. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
Trader Joe's you've heard of, Costco, Wild Oats, well-known brands, all three of them. Now, try this one, CRF Frozen Foods. You heard of them? Yeah, probably not. They supply frozen fruit and vegetables, organic and otherwise, to a whole mess of well-known brands, including the ones I just mentioned. Anyway, CRF's just issued a huge recall covering 360 different products possibly contaminated with listeria. That's bad, yes, but it is also, possibly, a business opportunity. Ashley Milne-Tite has that.
This food recall affects 42 different brands. It covers products processed and packaged at CRF as far back as 2 years ago. Haley Oliver is a food scientist at Purdue University. She says now outbreak investigations look so far into the past, companies can be held liable for a lot more than they used to be.
From an economic viability standpoint, that can be really challenging for some of these companies. And if you look in this instance, the amount of product that's about to be recalled, that can be financially devastating.
To the supplier under investigation, but it's no picnic for the supermarkets either. CRF, which is based in Washington State, is a big supplier, and it specializes in organic fruits and vegetables. Crisis manager Jonathan Bernstein says the store's recovery will depend to some extent on whether they have other suppliers lined up.
If they have to scramble now, then there's going to be a delay and obviously loss of revenue as a result.
As freezer shelves sit empty until new green peas and broccoli arrive. But Tom Perko of Bevmark Consulting says during times like this, some retailers look for a silver lining. They encourage consumers to try something else, something more expensive.
What they really want to do is switch you over away from the low margin, profit margin, frozen items and get you over there into that produce section they have. So this is an opportunity to actually make some money.
And now there are millions of consumers checking their freezers to see if their kids' organic vegetables should go in the trash. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Once you start to live this, a lot of your disposable income goes toward that. And that's when it becomes an economy.
A very, very big fitness economy. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 9 points today, less than 0.1%, 17,660. The NASDAQ down 8 points, 0.1% there as well, 47.17. The S&P 500 flat, 20.50. The number Fitbit down 18.8%. The maker of wearable fitness devices issued a profit forecast well below estimates. Tesla down 5% today on worse-than-expected quarterly losses. Ouch. Kellogg crunched down 2.5% on falling sales and earnings in this first quarter. Merck weakened 1.3% today after reporting worse-than-expected quarterly revenue and some disappointing sales. The food behemoth Kraft Heinz up 3.75% after demolishing analyst profit expectations. Allstate, the insurance company, up 4% today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 1.74%. I'm telling you, watch the bond market. You're listening to Marketplace.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million-dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You remember how, when you were a kid, your mom told you to never get into a car with a stranger? Yeah, well, about that. Uber, right? And other ride-sharing services? No, it's not an exact comparison. And yes, background checks are done. But on Saturday, the battle over how those background checks are done and by whom comes to a vote in Austin, Texas. From KUT in Austin, Audrey McGlinchey has the story.
Lyft drivers Monique Mitchell and Mo Rattel are spending an afternoon in Austin Zilker Park. They're armed with clipboards and pens. A few dogs feign interest in their pitch. But Mitchell and Rattel are here for the humans. Mitchell approaches two women.
Hello, how are you folks today?
Hello, how are you?
Good. We have a petition here basically to bring it to a public vote for ride-sharing companies like Uber and Lyft to stay in Austin. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if we could get your support with a signature.
But before signing, the women have a few questions. They bring up the subject everyone's talking about, background checks.
We were reading a little bit about that. You know, they have to be licensed as well as a taxi company and get background checks and all that. You know, I agree with that. I think that there should be some, you know, checks and balances,
definitely,
you know, to keep everyone safe. So is that somehow...
Somehow at the heart of all this? Yep. Driver Rattel explains that Uber and Lyft run background checks through third parties using a name and social security number. But a month before this day in the park, Austin council members voted on a mandate.
I'd just like to point out that both the FBI and the Texas Department of Public Safety agree that fingerprinting is the best way to ensure that the records reviewed belong to the person being checked.
Fingerprint-based background checks for drivers. The city requires them for taxi cabs, and council members say it's the only way to ensure drivers are who they say they are. But Uber and Lyft say why bandage what's not broken? Their background checks work well. Plus, the companies argue fingerprinting cripples their model of onboarding drivers quickly, what is for many drivers a part-time gig.
50% of our drivers are on the platform for less than 10 hours a week.
Uber representative Adam Blinnick spoke to council members in October.
So the more steps and the more costs and the more hoops you make someone jump through, the less chance they're going to take advantage of this economic opportunity and even test it.
I've been very clear from the beginning that I am for mandatory fingerprinting.
Austin Councilmember Delia Garza.
You could have the most comprehensive background check known to man, but if you're not background checking the right person, then it's worthless.
In December, the council voted in favor of fingerprinting. Weeks later, Uber and Lyft responded.
All right, folks, we're going to take our petition signatures into the city clerk right now.
Remember those Lyft drivers in the park? They helped collect more than 20,000 signatures, the number needed to force a public vote. The rules Uber and Lyft favor are almost identical to what the companies have been living under in Austin so far. Looser regulations that do not require fingerprints. On May 7th, Austin residents will vote on what's now known as Proposition 1. A vote for allows Uber and Lyft to keep doing their background checks, while a vote against ushers in a city-run fingerprinting process. In the meantime, mailboxes, radios, and TVs have been humming with campaign noise, most of it from one side.
We can all agree, ride-sharing drivers should have national criminal background checks. But on May 7th, we'll be deciding who should conduct them.
Uber and Lyft have funneled nearly $10 million into this campaign, because if they lose, they say they'll be forced to leave. In Austin, I'm Audrey McGlinchey for Marketplace.
True story. One day, my son and I, he was seven maybe, were walking past a spinning studio, one of those bicycle exercise places, and he looked at me and he said, "Dad, why don't they just ride their bikes outside?" I didn't then, and I still don't have an answer, but what we were looking at through that window wasn't so much an exercise class as it was a gold mine. Because between the flywheels and the CrossFits and the cardio bars and the pop physiques and just plain old strapping on a pair of sneakers and going for a run, fitness, writ large, is what the Wall Street types like to call bankable. That's the proposition in Jason Kelly's new book about the fitness economy. It's called Sweat Equity. Jason, thanks for coming into the studio.
It's great to be with you, Kai.
The money is unbelievable. $3.4 trillion all in, you say fitness is worth in this country.
Well, and it's what's so interesting about it, I think, is this idea that it has moved from activity to lifestyle. And once it moves to a lifestyle, then you're not just talking about buying a pair of shoes and buying a pair of shorts. You're talking about what you eat, where you go on vacation, who you hang out with. It's just this all-consuming thing that once you start to live this, a lot of your disposable income goes toward that. And that's when it becomes an economy.
How did we get here? Because I had Phil Knight, the founder of Nike, on the show a couple of weeks ago. And he, in 1962 or 4, whatever it was selling $8,000 worth of running shoes out of the back of his car. And now it's this.
It's this, and it's largely because of this generational shift, I think. If you go back to the 80s, you know, that's when you see Jane Fonda and Richard Simmons sort of come on the scene, right? And the videotapes. And and one thing that I think goes underappreciated is when Title IX gets instituted, suddenly there's
the law that required equal opportunity in athletics.
Exactly. So equal opportunity in athletics means that not just boys, girls grow up through secondary school and into college. And so suddenly you have people who were much fitter and are effectively sort of addicted to exercise.
There is also a mind and body thing going on here. And, you know, it's quasi-religious. Mm-hmm. It is almost culty in some ways. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, it is a symptom of our times in many ways, right? I mean, we are an anxiety-ridden, stressed-out people here, especially in the urban centers of the United States. You know, there have been a lot of studies around millennials especially not going to a lot of organized religion, but they are finding a lot of community in their social groups, and a lot of those social groups are manifesting around fitness boutiques, running clubs, cycling clubs. And part of it is people feel better after the exercise. It calms them down. And there's a lot of science around that. You know, you go for a run, you clear your head, you just sort of feel better. You feel like you can deal with your life a little better.
And you get into it. And one of my favorite anecdotes in this book is people tattooing the little Iron Man symbol on themselves. I mean, people are like branding themselves literally with the symbol of their exercise.
Literally branding themselves. Iron Man was sort of the first wave of that. But I mean, even with Tough Mudder, some of the gyms, I mean, people are really getting into it and they're self-identifying. And that's this whole notion that it's not just something you do, it's who you are. And you want to be seen as this sort of person who does it. One of my early tip-offs, you know, I've been covering Wall Street for a number of years. And when I started dealing with all the private equity guys and all the investment bankers, I started to notice that instead of wearing Rolexes, they were wearing Timex Ironman watches.
Oh, man.
Because they want to be identified as people who do those sorts of things.
As long as you're talking about it, wearables and Fitbits and that whole deal.
Absolutely. And the wearables is such an interesting window in, and technology in general has been a huge accelerant here. People love to measure things.
Speaking of which, you've got your Fitbit
I've got my Fitbit
on.
How
many steps today?
12,986.
Nice.
So I'm doing okay. I've got a 15,000 goal.
Oh, do you? All right.
I mean,
fine.
I'm in Los Angeles, so
overachiever. Fine.
I need to figure out a way to walk. Yeah. Went on a beautiful run this morning.
There you go.
But going back to what you were asking about in terms of the mindfulness piece, a lot of the social piece comes in some ways as a reaction to technology. You know, we have all of these sort of superficial relationships, and there is a deep craving for human interaction. And so people aren't just exercising in their basement. They're seeking out other like-minded people. And that's one of the real reasons that people will pay $25, $30, $35, $40 to go to a spinning class.
You and I are talking $35, $40 to go to a spinning class. Companies and businesses in this sector are talking ginormous amounts of money. Ironman sold for, did I read it in here? $1 billion almost?
That's exactly right. A very accomplished Ironman, a guy named Jesse Dubé, who I interviewed for the book, was a principal at Providence Equity Partners, highly accomplished athlete, and he essentially saw this opportunity to make an investment they run Ironman, yep. World Triathlon Corp. They expanded dramatically. And a Chinese company, Dalian Wanda, the same folks
sure.
who own AMC, come in and buy it. And now they are putting on the first Chinese Ironman races.
And can you imagine you get 1.3 billion people or some fraction thereof to pay $100 to run your race, right?
The numbers start to get pretty big. Yeah.
Jason Kelly is the New York bureau chief at Bloomberg. His book about the new economy of mind and body is called Sweat Equity. Jason, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
This final note on the way out today, in which finger-looking good takes on a whole new meaning. Kentucky Fried Chicken has introduced edible nail polish. Comes in original recipe and hot and spicy, just like, you know, the actual food. KFC apparently worked with McCormick, the spice company, on the, I guess you'd say formula, right? Because you can't really call it a recipe. Apparently, what you do is you lick it once it's on your nails, and it tastes just like chicken. Sadly, it's available only in Hong Kong. Also, ew. Hi, Kai Rizdahl here. Thanks so much for listening to Marketplace. You hear me do the numbers every day, but we aim to bring you more than the numbers. We give you the context you need to understand what's happening in the economy and why it matters to you. We'd like you to help keep our numbers strong by making a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace. And this month, your gift in any amount is going to be automatically doubled thanks to a dollar-for-dollar match from Newman's Own Foundation. So please donate today at marketplace.org. Maybe I'm the wrong guy to ask, but why do you want your fingernail polish to taste like chicken? Right? Anyway, the Dow up 9 points today, less than a 10%. The NASDAQ down 8 points, about a tenth there. The S&P 500 was flat. Golda Arthur, John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Eve Epstein, Nancy Fargali, George Judson, Suzanne Levy, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our managing editor is Mark Miller. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.